The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is the statement of divine oneness, that God is one. A oneness that includes and yet still remains one. The first paragraph is the individual's responsibility to draw that oneness into the world, which is through the mitzvah of loving God. And the way to do that is through all the mitzvah, through the study of Torah, and basically to totally envelop myself in Torah consciousness. When I'm walking on the way, when I'm getting up, when I'm lying down, when I'm sitting at home. And of course, what does that mean? That I always have to, like, you know, if I'm sitting at a meal, I have to somehow, in a rigid, mechanical way, say, oh, we better start speaking Torah now. No. It's like there's a consciousness that if a person does not speak Torah at a meal, so then the table, which is considered to be an altar, that table upon which has not been said Divrei Torah, that table becomes an altar for dead corpses. It's like disgusting. So what do people say? So they talk about everything and anything, the whole meal, and then all of a sudden somebody bangs on the table. Devar Torah now. Someone has to say Devar Torah now. The truth is, that's really not the ideal, because that implies that we haven't been speaking Torah at all the whole time. And then, for like 2 minutes, someone says a few words of Devar Torah, and then we go on. Right? And of course, when a person doesn't have a Devar Torah, what should they say? Something not prepared. They should say, it's written that on a table, if you don't say words of Torah, then the table is considered to be an altar of dead corpses. There's some Torah. And then you go on, you speak about everything else under the sun. That's not the point. Right? That's not the point. The point is that your conversation, you know, your life conversation is bound up with Torah. That's what you talk about all the time. Right? It's not like we're talking about something else and like, oh, we better start talking Torah. Right. But rather, it should be so integrated with us, so naturally part of our lives, that we're talking about it all the time. It's like, how do people come to loving football? Right. Lahavdil. How do people come to loving football? Well, first of all, they memorize all the scores. They memorize all the players. And they hang out with people who are into football. And all they do is they talk about football, football, football. And they wear a football shirt, and they get themselves a football helmet, and they put football posters all over their walls. Right? And if you do all of that, you'll be quite involved in football. Right? Well, that's what we do, but on a higher level, of course, in terms of creating a consciousness of God and our relationship with God, always. You're always speaking about it. When you're really into football, how can you not speak about it? And when you're really into meaning, values, ideals, Torah, how can you not speak about it? You're always speaking about it with your friends, with your family, when you're walking, when you're going down, when you go to sleep, when you wake up, it's on your mind all the time. It's a natural part of everything you're doing. So the first paragraph is the individual's responsibility to manifest the divine oneness in their lives and in the world, which is through the mitzvah of loving God. The second paragraph is the community's responsibility. As a community, if you do my mitzvahs, you shall do my mitzvot. We learn from here that a mitzvah brings us to another mitzvah. Vaya im shamoa tishma'u. And it will be, if you listened, you will listen. There's a fundamental idea in oral tradition that mitzvahs draw us to another mitzvah. Because mitzvot are not simply points. And what's one got to do with the other? Remember, mitzvot are like steps on the dance floor. And there is a dance. And of course, in a mechanistic way, we paint footprints on the floor. But there's so much between each footprint, and each footprint brings us to the next footprint. Because each movement of the dance already draws you into the next movement of the dance. Because it's not pieces, right? But it's rather a whole movement. It's a movement of life. And the mitzvot are not things that you do, but they're segments of life movements. Right? Segments of life movements. And so when you're in the move and you're in the groove, so of course it draws you to the next one. So if you listen, you will listen. Right? If you listen, you will listen. One mitzvah, just worry about doing one mitzvah, because that'll already help us and draw us and introduce us to the next mitzvah. We also learn an idea from here as to the nature of the study of Torah. That generally when someone studies something, the more they learn, the more full they become. And the less there is room to learn more. But with the study of Torah, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know anything. And the more you fill yourself up, the more room you discover within yourself for even more. You know, there's a Hasidic story. It's also a Musar story. One fellow came up to a rabbi and said, "Rabbi, I only have 1 hour to learn. I only have 1 hour to learn a day. What should I learn? Talmud? Should I learn halacha, Jewish law? Should I learn chumash? What should I learn?" The rabbi said, "You should learn Musar. Right? Musar. Ethics. Values. Because if you learn those things, you'll realize you actually have 2 hours to learn." When a person learns Torah, and they really learn Torah, they'll discover that they really have more time to learn Torah. So in a simple way, if you listen, you will listen. The one listening already opens my heart up, and there's room for even more listening. If you listen, you will listen to do my commandments, serve God. Then what will happen? You'll have rain, it's time, grass in the fields for your cows, and you will eat and be satisfied. The mitzvot create a world of harmony. That the relation between man and God is reflected in the world. And we talked about how in physics, everything is a relationship. Really, there are no such things as isolated entities, nor is there things in itself. But there's rather relationships. And whatever looks like a thing is a conceptualization of a relationship, so they're now saying in physics. And so Judaism always understood that the world is the conceptualization of our relationship with the divine. And so the mitzvot creating the harmonious relationship with the divine, what we will see, what we will witness on the stage of reality is a harmonious world that's in sync. Watch out, lest your heart should stray. The order becomes ordinary, and you'll need the extraordinary, and there won't be any rain, and the ground will not produce its produce. And now we come to what we're going to deal with today. And you shall be cast off the good land that God gave you. What is this talking about? Eretz Yisrael, of course. The ultimate, the climax of this whole process is you'll be thrown out of the land. And therefore you shall put these words that have commanded you on your heart and tie them as a sign on your arms, on your between your eyes. And you shall teach them to your children, speaking in them when you're going up, when you're getting down, when you're lying on, and write them on your doorposts and on your city posts, gateways, in order to increase your days and the days of your children on the land that God had promised you to give to you, like the days of heaven on earth. Now, what is this referring to? you shall be thrown off the land. And therefore, do the mitzvot to increase your numbers, increase the days of your children on the land. Now there's two ideas here that are very, very crucial to be appreciated. Why does it say, and you'll be thrown off the land, and therefore do the mitzvot to increase the number of days of your children on the land? And why does it have to say that? Isn't that obvious? It says, if you do my mitzvahs, you'll get X. Watch out. If you stop doing them, you'll get Y. On top of Y, you'll be thrown out of the land. And then it ends off saying, and therefore do my mitzvot to increase the days of your children on the land. There's no doubt, with a clear reading of the text, there is no doubt that the land of Israel is crucial to the meaning of being Jewish. The aspiration to live on this land, to build this land, and to create a mamlacha, a kingdom on this land, is primary to the meaning of being Jewish. It's not a detail amongst various details. It is a collective concern of the totality of being Jewish. I think I once mentioned to you, I was speaking to a rabbi in New York. We were discussing the possibilities of doing some work together. But I wanted to see where he's coming from. And I said, you know, so what's your way? What's your outlook in Judaism? He said, I believe in Torah. Straight Torah. Not Torah with an Eretz Yisrael shtick. Not Torah with the land of Israel shtick. Just Torah. I didn't say anything. I knew that I'm not going to work with this guy. Because what do you mean, shtick? Right? Any kid who could pick up this Bible, if you'd ask them what are the fundamental concerns of this Bible, the ongoing theme is, Abraham, I'm going to give you a land. Abraham, I'm going to give your children the land. There's not one mention in the entire book of Genesis that they're going to get a Torah. Now, isn't that strange? No mention of the Torah? I mean, isn't that the scene of scenes? The Jewish people getting the Torah? How come it doesn't say anything about getting the Torah? The whole beginning of the Bible is, you're going to get the land. I'm going to make you into a great nation. You're going to be thrown into exile, but you will come out a great nation. And I will take you back to the land. Is Torah the goal? Or is Torah the means? Got to get it clear. Right? Is the nation for the Torah, or is the Torah for the nation? You've chosen us amongst the nation and you have given us your Torah. What came first? The nation came first. Then God gave that nation a Torah in order to guide that nation to become that kind of model of national purity and holiness. The Torah starts off with a promised land. And it ends off, the entire book of Deuteronomy is addressing the people as they stand at the edge of 40 years of wandering to enter into what they've been waiting for, their land, to set up their government, to set up their judicial system, to set up agriculture, economics. That's what it's all about. I mean, anybody who'd read it as a kid could see that. It's a little frightening that there are certain rabbis that don't seem to see that. And the land of Israel is a shtick. Right? It's like a shtick. It's a very strange thing. Right? It's again part of the process where people have become experts in the details, but in the process have forgotten the all-encompassing themes wherein those details had meaning in the first place. The land of Eretz Yisrael, if you don't do those mitzvahs, you'll get thrown off. And, I mean, reading it, right? It sounds like that's awful. Right? That sounds like the climax. There won't be any rain, and there won't be any yield, and you will be thrown off from the land, the good land that I gave you. That's like, boom! As we're developing towards the culmination of the ultimate of ultimates, exile. Now that is truly odd when you speak to some Jews. Because as I once mentioned to you, a good friend of mine had a conversation with a woman. She was somewhere living in the States. And he was asking her about her community. And she was talking about the glatt kosher Hungarian restaurant, and the glatt kosher Chinese restaurant, and the glatt kosher... what? Mexican food. I mean, and she was going on and on how fantastic. They've got this completely kosher supermarket. They have a mikveh, which is crystal clear with a diving board. Just joking, right? I mean, we're talking about the highest levels of, like, wow. She was very excited about the Talmud Torah that her kids go to and the community services that they do. And she was just going on and on and on, which is really very beautiful. But it became a little too beautiful. So he says to her, he says, you know, you sound very happy here. She said, oh, indeed, we are very happy here. He said, no, 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 no. You sound like really happy here. I mean, like really happy here. And she said, to tell you the truth, I hope and pray that when the Messiah comes, he'll let us stay. Could you imagine this? He'll let us stay? Do you read the Shema every day? With the pain and the sorrow that we've been cast off the land? Doesn't sound like it. You want to stay? And the Bible promises that the Jews in the exile will not find for the sole of their feet any place of tranquility and restfulness. Sounds a little strange. Sounds a little strange. You know, when I was living in New York, I didn't want to go there, but there are certain reasons why you're allowed to leave the land of Israel. One of the reasons is to bring Jews back to Judaism. Well, and I asked around, should I go, whatever, I was offered a unique job. So I went, and I was living in an area in New York that was a very religious area. When I first got there, it was quite a while since I'd had a car. Finally, I get this car. And the company that I was working for, was the organization I was working for, was renting this car for me. Well, the first car that I got was this little car. You have to understand, when I first got into this little car, I felt like, vroom, vroom, look at me. I mean, it's been so long since I've had a car, and I'm zooming on the highway. Within a couple days, you know, I mean, there was no power steering, there were no power brakes, it was like a cheap rental car. Well, after a couple days, I started feeling uncomfortable, like, this car doesn't go fast enough. This car, I don't know, it's hard to turn the wheel. You have to say, the first time I turned the wheel, was like, wow, ugh, yeah, look at this. But after a couple days, I started saying, no, I don't know, the wheel's just too tight, you know, I need a better car. And so I started complaining, you know, I need a better car, you know, on these highways, you know, you need a better car, bigger car. So they got me a bigger car. So now I had power steering, power brakes, you know, and here I was steering the wheel with my finger, don't tell the police how I drive. And I was feeling, wow, you know. And then I started learning how to drive in New York highways, you know, you know. And then I started, and I just, like, moving into it. Now, we lived 3 blocks away from a mikveh. And this mikveh was gorgeous. Gorgeous mikveh. It had massage nozzles, you know what I mean, for the showers. It was crystal blue with these beautiful tiles. And you come into the door, it's free, and you have towels there for you, and little bars of ivory soap, right? Just like in the hotels, right? It was just wonderful. It was like a very high spiritual level, I must admit. I mean, it was just wonderful. This mikvah, and of course, every morning, we would jump out of bed and jump into my car to drive, you know, 3 blocks. I mean, you know, who has time to walk 3 blocks? And so we would drive to the mikveh, drive back from the mikveh. It was wonderful. There was Baskin and Robbins kosher. There was pizzeria kosher. It was like wonderful, wonderful. And it was very easy to say, this is great. I mean, I don't know any mikvehs that look like this in the land of Israel. I don't know any ice cream like this in the land of Israel. I mean, this is wonderful. This is really wonderful. And it's very easy to start to think, wow, look, I can serve God so easily here. I mean, I make more money here, so I don't have to work so much. I can learn more. Why would I want to come back to the land of Israel in the first place? Why would I want to come to a land that's really hard to make a living with all the bureaucracy that it takes? And why would I want to do that? In fact, one of the kings that the Jewish people had to fight before they came into the land of Israel, the name of that king was King Cheshbon. And you know what King Cheshbon means? Cheshbon means accounting. Like, you know, like your Cheshbon bank, your bank account. And that's what people have to fight with. Every Jew has to fight with the King Cheshbon before they come into the land of Israel. Because you have to, you know, can I get the kind of car I had over there? Can I get the kind of house I had? It's very, very frightening. Very, very frightening. I once heard of Scheinberger when he went to the States. He came back and he said, you know what frightens me about the States? It's not the materialism. It's the spiritualism. There's so much spirituality there that you might think that this is the land of Israel. Because you've got the mikvahs, you've got kosher, you've got yeshivas, you've got all this. But there's one thing you don't have. It's not your country. It's just not the land of Israel. And it's so easy to lose touch with that. And so easy to start with what we want and then interpret the Torah in the way it fits us. But we have to honestly read it. And recognize the goal of the Jewish people was to be in their land. And if there is no promised land, then there's no land to come back to. It's only the promised land that Jews are coming back to. There's no other reason to come back here. I mean, it says in the Bible that I gave you a land that is not missing anything. It has hakol. It has everything. Hakol? Hakol, it has everything? I mean, you can't even find a telephone, public telephone that works here, you know, that you have everything. And the lines you have to wait, and banks, and the, come on, it has everything? I mean, if I were to look around and think, most people would say, America, land of the free. America has everything. I'm going to go to Israel and come to a land that has everything? I mean, there are Russians. They don't want to come back here. They're getting out of Russia. They're getting out of exile. They're getting out of modern-day Egypt. Where do they want to go? They want to go to the United States. They don't want to come here. So you show them in the Bible. But it says, Hakol, it has everything here. So why are you going over there? It has everything over here. They look at you crazy. What, you think I'm nuts? I was born yesterday? I know what the land of Israel is like. I know where everything is. What is everything, anyways? Hakol. If the Bible says it has Hakol, then it has hakol. What is hakol anyways? Hakol, the all. It has all. The all is God. Because there's a big difference between the United States and the land of Israel. God gave the land of Israel to the Jews. And that means that this land is the divine present. And you know that a present embodies the presence of your beloved. And that's what makes it worth it. I'd rather have a morsel from someone who loves me as an expression of their care and love than a feast from someone who couldn't even care. The land of Israel has everything because when I'm in the land of Israel, I know it's the land that God promised to the Jews. And that's all I want. What more could I want than to be living in a place where I believe was given to me as a Jew, as a gift from the divine. A land where I can fulfill my responsibilities to God and my responsibilities to the rest of mankind. How's that possible? And yet that's why this land is so important. It has everything. A friend of mine wrote his friend, "I have never made so little money in my life and felt so rich." How can you feel rich here? Because you feel the richness of life. Because it is a land that is the stage upon which the Jews effectualize their relationship with God and their relationship to the rest of mankind. What a special land this is. Now, of course, not everybody can come tomorrow. The first thing Jews must recognize is this is where we want to go. At least that. And the first thing Jews should recognize is the deep-seated pain that I'm not there, that I'd like to be there. If I forget the exile, I will have forgotten the redemption. You know, it says, only he who cries over the destruction of the temple will rejoice in seeing it being rebuilt. Huh? Only if at the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept for Zion. Only those who sat and wept for Zion will be the ones who will in fact reap the harvest. That's what it says, Hazarim bedima berina yiksaru. Those who will plant with their tears, with joy they will reap the harvest. What it says in Scripture. Does that mean I have to forever live in the diaspora and just feel guilty and rotten? It means that Jews should recognize that the goal of being Jewish is not to be religious. It's to be more than just religious. It means to live a total life on this earth, which means also a citizen of a nation with national responsibilities. The religion of the Jewish people isn't a religion, and you can do it wherever you want. You could be a Buddhist wherever you want. You could be a Christian wherever you want. But to be a fulfilled Jew, ultimately, it's only in the land of Israel. That's what the Bible says. I can't apologize for it, and I'm not going to try. That's what it says. If anybody reads the Bible, it's very clear. We start with a promise, the land of Israel. We end with the entrance and the fact of fulfillment of that promise. We're in the land of Israel. And what connects the two promises? The promise and its fulfillment. What happens in the middle of the Torah? The giving of the Torah. As the conduit to the fulfillment of the promise as the Jews live in their land. If you don't do the mitzvahs, I'm going to throw you out of the land. Because if you're not doing the mitzvahs, you have forgotten the meaning of this land. I mean, what good is this land if it's not the place where I commune with God? I fulfill my relationship with God. What do we need land for? So the mitzvot are crucial to maintaining our portion in this land. Because it's not a land like any old land. It's that place for encounter with God. And I shall give you the land, and I shall be unto you an Elohim. That's what it says. We just learned it in the story of Abraham. I shall be unto you an Elohim. Close to you. Related to you. And it shall be unto you an achuzat olam. It shall be to you a possession for eternity. The oral tradition says a possession of eternity means through it you will possess the Eternal One. Encountering that kind of closeness and intimacy. So of course the mitzvot are crucial to ensure the Jews to stay in the land. Because the land is that place, that stage upon which the relationship between the Jews and God plays itself out. And if there's no play, there's no stage. Right? A stage is only worth the play upon which it is. If the Jewish people put on that stage the play called exile, well, you don't need this stage for that one. There are other stages. Exile meaning that I am exiling myself from the oneness of God. Exile meaning that I have disregarded the ongoing relationship available to me with God. Well then, there are other theaters to play that one out. You don't do that here. So it's really crucial to appreciate how important the land of Israel is. It's not just a detail. It's part of the all-encompassing theme of Judaism. It means God, the people, and the land. That's what it means. Creating a nation, not a religion. A nation on a physical piece of land. A nation as a nation in relationship with God. As I mentioned to you before, relationship with God on an individual level existed and exists in other religions too. I don't believe at the same level of precision and richness that Judaism is, but even so, we've got to be fair and recognize that as individuals, there are various ways to God. But on a national level, that's the nuance of Judaism. That a nation, as a nation, has responsibilities to God. Not just individuals. Not what's to God is God's, what's to Caesar's is to Caesar. And leave the state, leave the politics, leave everything else to Caesar, and then, you know, Sunday, it's God Day. God is for individuals. And as an individual, you must take into consideration God in your life. But as a nation, no. If you leave nationalism in the hands of people like Caesar, you'll see what will happen to the world. The only real way of seeing a world of peace is when the nations will see that a nation has a responsibility to God as a nation. And everything that is part of being a nation, which means land, which means politics, which means economics. So the land of Israel is crucial. It's not just another detail. It's not just a shtick. Right? It's not just a shtick. It's crucial. The question is, so when should the Jews come? That's the question. I can't imagine anybody who honestly reads the Torah arguing on the importance of the land of Israel. I find it really odd, surprising that anyone would argue with the Talmud that says, better live in the land of Israel in a city full of non-Jews than to live outside the land of Israel in a city full of Jews. Isn't that amazing? It's outrageous. I mean, who would even believe that? Written in the Talmud. Written in the Talmud. So that's very heavy. When to come? Of course, there are various opinions. When to come? There is the opinions that when God promised the land, He means Mashiach. You wait in the exile. You say, Gevalt when Mashiach comes, Gevalt when Mashiach comes. I think I once shared with you a story. We were at the home of very religious people in Toronto. And the woman of the house was saying, Gevalt, oy, when Mashiach comes, oy. And then she said, oh, next year in Jerusalem, my son's bar mitzvah is next year and it's going to be in Jerusalem. My wife said, oh really? When? She said, when Mashiach comes. So my wife said, but what if Mashiach doesn't come next year? She said, well, so we'll have to have the bar mitzvah here. What, Mashiach has to take care of your air flight fare also? I mean, you can't just get on a plane for like 2 weeks for your kid's, you know, your kid's bar mitzvah? No. There is an opinion. Gotta be fair. There is an opinion. You gotta wait for Mashiach. That the return to the land of Israel will be a mystical, celestial intervention into the world. Something very nice to believe in, but when you read the total Bible, where do you see that? Where do you see that in any of the promises of God, there was not the call of man to do what they had to do? When God said, I'm going to bring you to the land, how did the first Jews come into the land? War. It was war. They didn't just, I mean, it says, and I brought you on wings of eagles. That's a beautiful metaphor. A metaphor to recognize that all the physical toil, labor of the Jewish people to get back to the land has an underlying providence of God. But the people were doing something. Where do I see in the Bible when the Jews came out of Egypt that they landed mysteriously in the land of Israel all of a sudden? Nowhere. And just as God in the Bible promises us agricultural prosperity, nobody sits around and prays for the seeds to grow, the seeds that you didn't plant, nor did you water, nor did you spend the time and the toil to till the soil. Where in the world would anybody come up with this idea that God's promise means that you don't have to do anything? There's no foundation for that in the Bible. But there are those people who still think, you know, we'll wait and we'll pray, and all of a sudden one day, LL will be offering, right, free tickets, and we're all just going to get on it. And it doesn't take anything from us. That's counter-Judaism. That's part of the Christian saved complex. Believe and you'll be saved. And that's all you've got to do. Nothing. Just believe. And when you look in Judaism, Judaism says, no, you've got to do something. That's the gift of God. The gift of God is you're going to have to do something. The gift of God is you can create yourself just like God, so to speak. That's the gift of God. When the Jewish people were in the desert, they didn't want to come to the land of Israel. Why didn't you want to come to the land of Israel? They sent spies, we want to check it out. They came back, they said there's a land that eats its inhabitants. And they brought back these fruits that looked humongous. We're talking about grapes that were just gigantic. And they said, look at the fruits of this land. Could you imagine what it takes? This kind of land to cultivate those kind of fruits? You know what? Well, frightening. And isn't this amazing? Everyone got nervous and said, let's not go. Can you imagine? The whole story is going back to the land. The Jewish people said, let's not go. Let's stay here. Why in the world would they in any way entertain the thought of staying in the desert. Obviously, we can serve God. We can sit and study Torah all day long. We can sit and meditate all day long. Our clothes never wear out. Our shoes never wear out. There's bread coming out of the skies. What better utopia than that? We'll stay here in the cloud of God. God says, no. The greatest gift is the bread that you produced. That's the greatest gift. To do it on your own. To build it on your own. The 40 years of the desert is like the embryo in the womb of the mother. But then you've got to be born into a world and be a big boy and girl and take your life into your hands. That's the greatest gift. What greater gift can parents give their children? The opportunity for their children to stand on their own two feet and fend for themselves. To taste that beauty of independence and therefore possibility for relationships. And so yes, the land of Israel is going to require a lot of work. People come to the land of Israel and say, this is the chosen land, this is the gift of God. Couldn't God give us a more fertile land that's easier to deal with? Come in this place, rocks and desert, and this is what God gives me. It's a land that offers the greatest potential for your self-actualization. It's a land that's going to demand your involvement. Real work. Real toil. Obviously, people don't want to come back to the land. You have to understand, it's the promised land. So there are those people who have the opinion that, when Mashiach comes, we'll go. I personally cannot find any position like that. In terms of some kind of effortless return to a land that since the beginning of Jewish history, it demanded effort. Demanded effort. This notion that it's all in God's hands and He'll take care of everything and we don't have to do a thing. We have to do something. We have to do something. In my mind, there's no doubt that the responsibility to return to the land of Israel already exists for all Jews. But now, in terms of particulars, individuals, on a national level, the Jewish people as a nation have the most unique opportunity that has ever been presented in the entire history of the Jewish people. A sense of independence. We're not completely independent yet. As a nation, we could pass this opportunity up, as we unfortunately did after the destruction of the first temple. We again had the possibility to return, and a lot of people didn't want to go back. They wanted to stay in Babylon. Can you imagine that? After all the weeping at the rivers of Babylon, within 70 years they already got so into things and so comfortable that to move their homes and the difficulties it's going to take to get up and go, they already weren't ready to go. And the first group of people that went back to the land of Israel was a small band of people. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. Again, the same problem of misunderstanding the real gift of God, which is the possibility for you to create the world, for you to be a partner in your faith. With God. So, but on an individual level, there are fundamental reasons why a person is certainly allowed to leave the land of Israel. Number one, it's to save Jews, whether it's physically or spiritually. Number two, it's to find your soulmate. If you cannot find your soulmate here, you've been looking high and low, and maybe it's time to make a change. Number three, if you cannot make a living, you just cannot make a living. A person has to make a living. And number four, for the study of Torah. What if there's absolutely no place here that you could study Torah? There's no place here to study Torah. You'd be allowed to go.
How can that?
Well, in the past, there were times where the place was so barren and there was nobody around that a person doesn't have to go. In terms of doing something for the Jewish people, that's a very serious concern. Something that I personally deal with often. Maybe I should go to the States. Maybe I could do more in the States than here. But I feel that I really can do much more from here, or at least create the base from here. But it is a very serious concern in terms of what you could do for the Jewish people, in terms of the kind of work that you could do to raise the consciousness of our people and to redirect them back to the land of Israel. In terms of finding your soulmate, thank God there are plenty of men and women around here, but there are certain situations that I have to admit that I would tell somebody, listen, you've hung out for a while already, you've gone out a lot, maybe just go for a couple months to New York and see how things go there. In terms of making a living, of course, a person has to come to a honest evaluation of what that means. What that means. Two cars, a mansion, a couple of servants. It's a little difficult in Israel. Although I have to tell you, although people kvetch, there are a number of very rich Israelis, believe it or not. There are people who do own all those companies somewhere, right? I mean, someone's owning these big companies in Israel. So there are big companies, and there is the possibility of making money here in a big way. But then again, there's no mitzvah to make money in a big way. And there's no transgression either, right? We have to also appreciate, what do I have to do? Right? What do I have to do? And maybe I'll figure out a way to generate capital from the United States as I live here. Right? There are people who do that. People who do that. They generate capital from the United States. They have businesses that run and they work it from here. And of course, in terms of the study of Torah, there is no Torah like the Torah of the land of Israel. And thank God we're in an era where there are so many learning institutes that it's very odd that a person could say, I cannot find my place here. Cannot find my place here. But in terms of coming, a person has to be realistic about themselves. It would be a mistake to come and not be able to personally deal with it and then just run away. That's just the facts. And therefore, even though Rav Kook was considered to be a great Zionist, in one of his letters, he received a letter from a fellow in Austria telling Rav Kook that he would like to come to the land of Israel, asking him what does he suggest. And of course, most people, knowing any of the writings of Rav Kook, and he became somewhat the model of Zionism, religious Zionism, for some strange reason, because he was certainly not the only Jew that felt that way. Abraham felt the same. He wrote back to this fellow, be cautious, be careful, and plan it out well. You've got a family, you've got responsibilities, and be really, really careful to do it right, so that when you come, you can stay. And that's valid. That's very valid. That a Jew who authentically connects to being Jewish, that a Jew doesn't say, I want to live in the land of Israel, and I'll figure out how I'm going to do that, that's the greatest contradiction to what it means to be Jewish. At least every Jew. Then how I'm practically going to get there, I don't know. That's individual. It might take some people 1 year, it might take some people 5 years. There are other situations, you know. I met a fellow. He's divorced, and his wife has custody of the kids, and he knows his wife will never come to the land of Israel. He wants to be close to his kids. Well, that's a serious consideration. The beauty of Judaism is it is collective and it involves individuals. But the individuals have to ask themselves that question and ask their rabbis that question. And I had a student that went back to New York, and she was sitting for Shabbat at a rabbi's home. And she said to him, "So what do you think about the land of Israel?" And he became defensive and said, "I don't want to hold down two jobs to make a living." She didn't even say that. And then being defensive all of a sudden. Not only be defensive, every individual has to see their own individual situation in terms of how realistic is it for me right now in a way that I could do it in a real way, in a lasting way, and be contributing to the country. Right? Not find myself on welfare, is I really contributing to the country? And certainly every Jew throughout the world should recognize their commitment to the land of Israel. Their understanding that more than the land of Israel needs them, they need the land of Israel. And when Jews say, "We're going to cut off our ties with the land of Israel, we don't like the politics." When Jews talk to me about my government, right? Like Israeli government is my government because I live in Israel, but if I was living in America, George Bush is my president. It's not true. The government of the land of Israel is actually the government of the Jewish people, to a certain extent, because this is our land. And wherever a Jew lives, or for whatever particular reason they feel they're not able to make that move now, they should be dedicated to contributing to the building of the land of Israel. Right? Because that's what it's all about. So if I can't contribute to creating a nationhood, and I'm not ready to do that, whether it's practically or maybe even emotionally, or I don't know, at least I should be dedicated to the building of the land of Israel. Because that's what it's all about. It's that promised land. That's what it's here for. It's our land. I heard a story, it was really, really interesting. It happened in, from what I remember, it was in Austria. And there was a party of various political figures. And a friend of mine told me the story. The ambassador of Israel walked in. And one of the non-Jewish other figures, political figures, said, "Oh," he announced him, right, his entrance, and he said, "Please welcome the ambassador of the Jews." Very strange, right? He should have said the ambassador of Israel. He said the ambassador of the Jews. And this fellow who heard this said to me, and I realized that they realize that the government of Israel is not simply the government of Israelis. The government of Israel is the government of the Jewish people throughout the world, whether they voted for it or not, whether they have the right to vote for it or not. But that's how the rest of the world views it. When Israel does something, they cannot differentiate between Jews and Israelis. For the world, they're the same thing. Right? It's your government that did it, Jews. Yes, you Jew in Oklahoma. Yes, you Jew in Savannah, Georgia. Yes, you Jew, wherever you are. Because this is our land. So it says, and you'll be thrown off the land. And there's so many Jews that say this every day. And they don't say it with the pain. At least the pain. Here we are thrown off our land. And with the expectation, the yearning of, hey, let's get back. An opportunity. This is an opportunity. We could pass this opportunity up again. Not like it hasn't happened before, unfortunately. And it even goes stronger than that. Rabbeinu Bachaya, very important commentary, brings down a midrash that explains that the essence of the performance of the mitzvot are in the land of Israel. And outside the land of Israel, the performance of the mitzvot are in the level of practice so that they won't be new for us when we get back to the land of Israel. It's a heavy thing to say. A heavy thing to say. What does it mean? There are certain commentaries, certain opinions that believe that the power of the mitzvah in terms of its ultimate power is in the land of Israel. Outside the land of Israel, it's crucial for the Jews to perform the mitzvot because it will be through those mitzvot that they will merit to come back to the land and then within the land perform the mitzvot. Very interesting. Very interesting. The mitzvot in the land, outside the land of Israel, are crucial for the preservation of the Jewish people. But in terms of growing forward, that ultimately can only be drawn from the land of Israel. It's that heavy. It's that heavy. So, it's not a shtick. It's not a shtick. Land of Israel. I don't have a land of Israel shtick in my Torah. I just teach Torah. I don't know what he teaches. It's a little strange kind of thing to say. But I've heard it before. Unfortunately. A Jew is part of a nation. A nation has a land. A land was promised. The mitzvot was the lifestyle that befits the Jew in the land that the Jew will live in. And it's in that land where the Jews will demonstrate that not only can individuals be holy, something that other religions perhaps could also teach, and there are plenty of beautiful, holy individuals throughout the world that are not Jewish, the Jewish people's mission was to go beyond teaching people how to be individuals and holy individuals. The Jewish people's mission was to teach the world that you could be a holy nation. And the land of Israel itself has certain special qualities that just being in the land of Israel, the oral tradition says we have a higher consciousness. We have a higher consciousness. And the Zohar, in Parshat Acharei Mos, says anybody who lives in the land of Israel has divine inspiration. Just being here. Anybody. You gotta understand this. Anybody. The Zohar says that anyone who dies in the land of Israel will die the famous death called the kiss of death. Now what's the kiss of death? Aaron and Moses died this lofty death called the kiss of death. Moses saw Aaron die this way and he said, oh please, he prayed that he should die that way. What's the kiss of death? You died from being so close to God. Your physical body could no longer support the kind of oneness you enjoy with God. And you just leave the body. Leave the body. It's not dying. It's being born. Just as when you're being born from your mother, you leave her body, there's a new level of birth where you're born out of your body. Through the kiss of death. As if God kissed the person, so to speak. And that kiss drew them out into a whole higher realm. You have to understand that that is quite amazing. Aaron, holy Moses, right? I mean, wow! So what's so great about these people if the Zohar says that anybody who will die in the land of Israel will die that way? Anybody. Even some guy sitting on the Barzalim on Jaffa Street or King George with his hairy chest sticking out, eating fustikim, you know, eating policies, right? Even that anybody who lives in the land of Israel is going to die this way. So what was so great about Moses and Aaron? They did it even outside the land of Israel. Right? Can you imagine that? That was the greatness of Moses and Aaron. Did they die that unique process of death outside the land of Israel? But anybody will die that way in the land of Israel. The land of Israel has always meant for the Jewish people a dimension of higher consciousness for the Jewish people. Because it's here that offers that special meeting ground for the Jew and God. You know, like there are certain favorite cafes that you often met your beloved, and it just has the right dynamic. And you like to go back to this coffee house because it's there that there's something about the atmosphere that is just so conducive to really establishing that kind of relationship between yourself and beloved. So too for the Jewish people, it was always understood there's something very special about this land. So much so that the Zohar says, you know, God didn't say to Abraham, Lech Lecha, when he was just sitting around. If you read the Bible, Abraham was already on his way. He was already on his way. God said, Lech Lecha, but if you read just before Lech Lecha, he had already left his place. He was already in transit. And where was he going? He was already on his way to the land of Israel. You know that? He was already on his way to Israel. And then God said, Lech Lecha. Why? The Zohar says something really quite amazing. You know, there are various people, various kinds of scientists who do experiments, investigations, right? Certain people measure the calcium level in water or the various nutrient levels in lands. You know, various people do research. The Zohar says that Abram was actually a researcher, right? Certain people are geologists. Abram was a spiritualologist. And Abram, the Zohar said, had figured out a way to measure spiritual densities of various countries. And he was doing his research, getting God consciousness readings on the various different countries in the world. This is always it. Well, when he started to do his calculations for the land of Canaan, which of course is the land of Israel, everything went haywire. I mean, he could never get one reading straight. Everything just contradicted each other. All the formulas that had worked for his research in any other city, country, for the spirituality of the place, just didn't work. So Abram said, I have got to go to this place. So the Zohar says. And when he said, I've got to go to this place, when he made the first move, then God said, go to yourself. And that's always the case in Judaism. God always wants the Jews. You take the first move towards me, and I'll take even two moves towards you. But you start. You start. You initiate. You make that move, and you show in a self-assertive way that you want to do it. And you'll see you'll get all the help in the world. So, in the Shema each day, the Jewish people remind themselves of the importance of the land of Israel. How it is fundamental to our faith, fundamental enough that it's part of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Fundamental enough to demonstrate God's oneness, that God is so one, That his oneness not only includes an individual, his oneness includes a nation, not only a nation, but includes a physical land and all the various apparent mundane responsibilities that it takes to build a country, build a state. All that is included within the oneness of God and is a function of relationship with God. And it's there that the Jewish people, on a specific particular piece of land, it's there that the Jewish people will testify to that kind of transcendental oneness.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.